Number four of the ongoing oral history interview with Professor Harold Scheub on August 16th, 2005. He is on his way to Cairo.
So I'm in Central Egypt. And Central Egypt, you really have a sense of that incredible Egyptian civilization. On one side, the great Karnak Temple, and on the other side of the Nile, the Temple of Queen Hatshepsut. So I'm walking out into the Sahara Desert on the Queen Hatshepsut side of the Nile with one person, a guide. And we're walking out into the desert, and pretty soon it seems like, you know, the Sahara Desert is not maybe a kind of a desert that one often perceives of as plain sand. There are hills and mountains and so forth there too. You come to a place they now call the Valley of the Kings. And it looks, there's nothing special about this area where he takes me. There's a hole in the earth. And I remember there, in order to keep the sand from caving in on this hole, there's a wood sort of a coating on the thing. No electricity. This man has a piece of reflecting tin foil that catches the rays of the sun. And I learn that there are bits and pieces of tinfoil all along the way in this tunnel to catch the rays of the sun, to light your way. Uh-huh. So I crawl into the tunnel. It's almost claustrophobic as you move into this, and you pretty soon time, you're moving in this darkness with all these bits of light, you know, that are caught from the sun, flashing around you. And pretty soon you feel like you're in Middle Earth. And way off in the distance, also catching the rays of the sun, bits and pieces of orange and red, flashing, flashing, flashing. And you come to this area, and it's the outer room of the tomb of King Tutankhamun, discovered, I think, in 1926 by a British archaeologist. And at this time, everything is still pretty much there. They've now taken almost everything out and taken it to the museum in Cairo. So this is in 1963. When I was coming back from Uganda, 62 or 63. And I'm there alone, and there's this unreal, surreal kind of all this light flashing around, all around, 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 you know, caught from the rays of the sun. And it really, the experience really taught me the potency of storytelling, because all around the walls of his tomb are stories in hieroglyphic form, these ancient stories. And so in this place, under the earth, with the stories on the mythic stories on the walls, and the body, the mummified body of King Tutankhamun, I still to this day try to put together what this really meant to me, that suddenly I was weightless, I was in this time warp. 3,000 years ago, this boy king, and slowly developing my interest in storytelling, and here I was in this incredible storytelling kind of an environment. It was a very remarkable experience. So, let me bounce from being under the earth to being over the earth. So I'm in Madison, I'm teaching, and this is in the early 70s. I can't remember the exact year. And I go to Khartoum in Sudan to deliver a paper at an international conference on storytelling, on oral tradition. So I'm coming back, and while I'm coming, I still remember this, while I'm coming back, I'm looking out of the window and I'm thinking about what we had been talking about at the storytelling session, and part of the theme of my paper was that we all have our stories to tell, and we create stories to tell them. So I come back to Madison, no problems, international flight, no problems. And it's in January, I think. And I was going to, before school started, I was going to go to Ann Arbor to visit some friends. So I catch a plane here that was going to land in Milwaukee and then go on to Detroit. It's 727 Northwest or Northwest Iowa. Then I think it was called Northwest Orient in those days. And in Milwaukee, this guy gets on the plane, and among other people, the plane is fairly crowded. It's not packed, but it's fairly crowded. A lot of kids, I think, as I recall. And I thought the guy was acting peculiar. I was sitting way in the back of the plane, and he was sitting ultimately on the floor by the pilot's door. And he had a briefcase. And then I was back in the back, so I heard the stewardess talking on the intercom to the pilot and learned that we were being hijacked. And
the plane had taken off?
Yeah, we were over the plane taken off. And remember, in these days, they don't have these things you go through to, you know, so he's got a hatchet.
And a hatchet?
And a bomb in a briefcase. And and then nothing is said by the pilot until we near Detroit. And then he says that we're being hijacked, and the guy wants to go to Algeria. But the pilot said that he had convinced him that 727 will never get to Algeria, so the guy is content with going to Cuba. So the plane lands in Detroit. And I still remember, it goes to a remote area of the an apron of the runway, and there are red lights. It's a sea of red lights. I think every cop in Michigan is there. And it takes, it seems like it takes an awfully long time to refuel. The guy will not let anybody off the plane. Kids, nobody. Everybody stays on the plane. And then we take off. And it was a really interesting... again, coming back to me, I remember on this plane, this idea that we all have our stories to tell, and is this the end of my story? And the plane was dead quiet. It was an amazing thing. Not a word out of anybody. Kids. You just sensed that tension in the plane and the guy sitting there. An African American, turns out later on, very unhappy with life in America. And so the plane lands in Havana at Jose Marti Airport, and these guys got on the plane, these Cubans in these military uniforms like Castro used to wear, and take this guy off the plane. And the plane taxied over to the airport, and we got off the airport. I remember that we were on Swiss television, and we were told that Castro himself had to make the decision about whether we were going to be able to leave. And so we went into the airport, and they fed us. And then we were there 13 hours, and then we were released. I still remember flying out of, when we all got on the airplane and the plane finally took off from Cuba, everybody applauded the pilot. And we landed in Miami, and just to show you how primitive hijacking was in those days. Northwest gave us handfuls of nickels to go on the telephone and to call our loved ones and to tell them that we were safe. And then the FBI met us at the airport and took away all the Cuban rum and Cuban cigars that everybody had purchased at the when we found that we were leaving.
Come on,
yeah,
really?
No sense of humor at all, those guys. And I never did get to Ann Arbor. I had to get back to Madison. And when I came back to Madison, up on the 14th floor here in Van Nuys, was a huge banner that said, "Fly the friendly skies." And then a few years ago, this guy came back to the United States.
The hijack.
Yeah, they were pretty rough on him. He worked in the sugar plantation. He lost an eye. They had an article in the Washington Post and the Milwaukee Journal about him. He was very unhappy with Nixon and with what was going on in this country, but then he found out that he was less happy with Castro and what was happening in Cuba, and so when he came back, I think they put him in jail for 15 years or something like that. But he did come back to this country. So going under the earth and being above the earth, and it reminded me of, in strange ways, of storytelling and how we all have our stories to tell.
It's, I will just make the only editorial comment of working on these oral histories. It is astounding to me the richness of everybody's personal story.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. It's amazing. I agree. I am, from my working in the oral traditions.
Yes.
I also, you know, you can take a remote farmer living in a Zululand, and he's got a wonderful story to tell. And you know, I saw the other day on the campus, they had this trailer. It looked like a house trailer that was collecting oral histories of people.
Oh, really?
I think it's run by PBS. Oh. And they were hanging around for about a week and just invited people to come and tell their story. One part of the story I didn't tell you, reminded me of this, Bob. This is back when I was in South Africa during apartheid. And it's, again, one of those experiences that sort of stands out in my mind. I knew a woman who taught Zulu at the University of the Witwatersrand. And a white woman who lived in Parktown, which is a suburb of Johannesburg. Mm. And I mentioned the racial makeup of people because under apartheid it assumes great importance.
Yes.
I was at her house in her apartment in Parktown for dinner one evening, and present at the dinner were a number of, a member of the Anglican Church was there, a variety of people, about eight people. Middle of the night, and there's a knock on the door, and she knew what, she was involved in this, she knew what was happening. She opens the door, and here come two young blacks, plainly frightened, you know, about what, I would guess 20, 22, 23 years old. And it turns out that her apartment is a part of an underground railroad that gets people out of the country into Botswana to freedom because they're in trouble with it, you know, or they're being taken for military training, you know, as a part of the African National Congress or something. And so it was quite an experience because they stayed for a while because then they would go on to their next the next juncture, but they had to stay, make sure they're safe and so forth. And while they were there, they had a lot to say, and it was really quite interesting to hear them talk. Turns out that all of these white people who were there were a part of this underground railway that regularly provided, these are very respectable university professor, very an Anglican minister, very respectable members of the community who are actively engaged in the anti-apartheid movement. And when these young people talked, it wasn't as if there was a distance between them and these other whites. You know, there was a collegiality there between them, which spoke wonders for what South Africa is trying to become, and that is an amalgam of people of different races. And so here were the races actively engaged in an activity against this very repressive government, and it really impressed me. So they were there for a while, telling their stories. You know, they had been very bright people. Of course, never got to universities. Went through high school in these apartheid black schools, and now were actively engaged in attempting to free their country. And so they saw themselves as soldiers, but it was clearly the beginning of their military activities because they were very nervous, and understandably, you know, this is the way Mandela and Biko were caught as they moved from one place to another. You know, it's always very dangerous.
Do you mind commenting on your perspective on the evolution of South Africa as a political state and what your assessment is of it today and its future, pro or con as a democracy?
Yeah, I have a lot of hope for South Africa.
You do?
Yes. When South Africa got freedom in 1990 and then the first vote for Africans in 1994, you know, that decade, probably about 10,000 people died I don't know if that figure is right, but I think it's around that, in various events in South Africa. But remember that in this country, we had a civil war that was ruinous as we attempted to struggle with facets of this country.
Yeah.
So I think that South Africa, you know, a lot of people were convinced that South Africa would get freedom only through a bloodbath of a horrendous nature. Mm-hmm. And it turns out it didn't work that way. First of all, I think, again, to go back to something I said earlier, I think there's no question but that something that happened miles away in Germany, the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of communism had an enormous impact on what was happening in South Africa, because South Africa could no longer be assured of support from England, and Margaret Thatcher had been a very active supporter, although openly opposed to apartheid, but she still supported the government and this country. You know, my feeling was that when de Klerk, the prime minister, yes. You know, when they let Mandela out of jail, you know, he pretty much knew that a lot of whites did not think that they were going to lose power so quickly, you know. But again, some people think once the genie was out, it was out. But another thing is, I think the people in control knew that there was no way that they were going to be able to continue the way they were going. That Africans had to become a part of this, and if Africans were going to be a part of this, they were going to rule it because they had the sheer numbers, and the country belonged to them. And so, you know, de Klerk and Mandela both got the Nobel Peace Prize. I thought Mandela deserved it. I think that de Klerk, I think it was a wise thing for the Nobel Committee to do, from political points of view. But I think that if you look at it from a historical point of view, I don't think South Africa had much of a choice. It was ungovernable, getting ungovernable by that time. They had taken Mandela out of jail a couple of years earlier than that. We know this now, and took him secretly around the cities and so forth to show him how South Africa had changed in the years that he had been locked up, and seeing none of this. My feeling is, all kinds of things can happen. And, you know, all kinds of things have intervened now, not least of which is AIDS, which has had an enormous effect in South Africa. But all other things being equal, I have always felt that South Africa will make a multiracial society work probably more quickly than we do in this country.
Really?
I think that we're sluggishly moving towards it. But, you know, look, one of the things that happened in the 1990s under the tutelage of Mandela and Bishop Tutu was something called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Yes.
We've never done that here, where South Africa tried to come to terms with its past.
Yes.
We've never. We've closed our eyes to 200 years of slavery in this country. What happened with this Truth and Reconciliation Commission is this commission, for a period of years, went around South Africa to all cities and so forth and allowed anybody who had a story to tell his story. It's a storytelling kind of a thing. Whites and blacks went before the commission and told their stories, and the commission had the right to grant amnesty to them. So some, and so I mean, we're getting, all you have to do is go on the internet under the TRC and see some of these stories. We're learning things about apartheid that we would never have learned otherwise. From a historical point of view, that's useful. But from a human point of view, what's happening is, Tutu's idea is this. We could have had a Nuremberg trial kind of a thing. But they chose to go this way, where, and they did grant amnesty to a lot of blacks and a lot of whites who were, you know, who were clearly murderers and so forth. Some of them they did not grant amnesty to. They haven't granted amnesty yet to the people who killed Biko. Biko's family is very much against amnesty. But as Tutu says, you know, the family itself, it's understandable that they would be opposed to this. We've got to look at this in the broader terms. And if a person, white or black, is feeling what they consider to be real sorrow for what he did, then they'll grant amnesty. Or a variety of other reasons too. But this, we don't know yet. We'll know in two generations whether the Truth and Reconciliation had any impact. But this is their attempt to deal with it, to come to terms with the past. The argument was, Mandela's argument was, how in the heck are we ever going to move if we remain mired in the history of apartheid. And this was one effort made to try to extricate themselves from this. It's not going to be, it's not 100%, but it's an attempt. They tried it in Chile, but in Chile, they did not have the amnesty clause, so it didn't work. Nobody would tell the story. In South Africa, because the amnesty possibilities were there, we get stories, incredible stories, awful stories about what apartheid was like. It really dates from the early 60s up to the 90s. That's pretty much the dates that they dealt with during this period. So, you know, and it's not that South Africa's not having trouble. And there still are many Africans in South Africa who would like to see the whites driven into the sea. But a lot of other people are saying no, that we are a multiracial kind of a country. It's built into, they have one of the most far-reaching constitutions on earth, a Bill of Rights, modeled on the United States Bill of Rights, but a Bill of Rights that goes, that protects women, protects gays. It is a very, very wide-reaching kind of a thing. So there was a real effort.
Really?
Yeah.
In South Africa?
Yes.
I mean, I consider myself literate and well-read, but did not know.
It's a it's an enormously, and a lot of people are not in favor of that. And so, you know, there's a debate that's going on. So they had a rough time, but it's only been a decade since the Africans have been allowed to vote.
Right.
So my feeling is, and they've had a rough time. The rand is the currency is way down to the dollar. When I worked in South Africa, the rand was almost equal to the dollar. Now it's very low. So they've had a rough time. They haven't been able to provide all the African people with decent housing yet, with decent plumbing and electricity, which they promised them, you know? So they got a long way to go, but the Africans have been very patient, at least so far, with this process. They believe in their government. And there are, the government is multiracial, and whites, blacks, coloreds, and Indians, all parts of the population engaged in this. So I'm very hopeful about South Africa, and I think the reason that I think that they're going to make it work is because they have been more open about their past. I think that we touched on it, Clinton touched on it a little bit, but not to the extent that, and I don't know if reparations is the answer, but somehow to come to terms with a past that we've been content to just, you know, keep closed. And I think South Africa opened that, and once they opened it, it remains open. Once again, it really emphasizes how important stories are. And the thing is, maybe the stories are false. I mean, maybe the stories, every story is told from my point of view, from this point of view, from that point of view. But story is all we have in the end. And so somehow, through story, maybe they're going to make this thing work. And the stories are awful. And especially the destruction of young people and so forth that have been involved. So, I think I've met enough people from all parts of South African life, to feel comfortable. Anything can happen.
Of course.
And dreadful things can happen. But I'm very hopeful. When I think about my career, and by the way, I should talk about my career in some respects being an accidental career, because and it really is a testimony to this idea of you seize the moment.
Uh-huh.
I tell my students this regularly, that when I started out, I had no idea the circuitous route that I would take. And I don't regret a moment of it, but it shifted and changed and snaked and went this way and that. And I kind of like the idea, I know that young people come to this university, as they come to any university, and many of them have pretty much an idea of what they're going to do with their life. We know those of us who work in the university, that it's not going to work that way, because at least 50% change their majors, we are told. And my argument to students is, don't be afraid of that. Don't be worried about that. And don't make, don't feel that you have got to have everything sort of shaped right from the start. It's not going to work that way. And you have to be open to ideas. And sometimes, you know, when you take a chance, it might be the wrong decision. My philosophy is, it's never a wrong decision. So that when Africa just altered me so completely, and when I think about Africa and what it did to me, it's such a stupid thing on my part that I couldn't have known this from the start. And that is, kids are brought up in this country with these stereotypes of Africa. We won't let them go. We have stereotypes of African people, African institutions, and so forth, that are left over from colonialism and before colonialism. Yes. And our kids get this on television in a variety of different ways. And, you know, it's embarrassing to say that 2 years after Uganda, you know, my conclusion was, heck, there's no difference here. The people are the same. There is no difference between people. Why did I have to go to Uganda for 2 years to learn this? I mean, why couldn't I have known this from simply my own experiences as a human being? But what we have done, we people in the West, is we've created this us and them kind of categorization. And we force people in to this them categorization and do not let them behave like adults. When you're living among people, every day, a day to day, and I tell my students too, don't be a tourist. You know, go and stay in a place for a time and get to know people. And then you learn that lesson. A lesson that cannot be taught in the classroom. We don't do it very well in the classroom. Not taught by reading. You've got to be there. And then it changes you. One of the things that happened to me, Bob, I can no longer go to a place and just be a tourist. You know, museums, yeah, okay. I can go to museums, I can see buildings that interest me, but all those people who are walking around there, you never get to know them. I was in Greece and went a circuitous route into Albania once.
Oh.
And I wasn't supposed to be there because, no. You know, the Cold War and all that stuff. And, you know, I saw these ancient cities and, you know, these old wonderful buildings and so forth, and thought to myself, I don't know anything about these people, these people who are walking down the streets and so forth. I know nothing about them. From that moment on, I couldn't be a tourist anymore. It's no good to go to another place if you don't know these people. If all you're doing is going to museums and seeing the architect, okay, maybe there's something to be said about that, but that's not what the living thing is. The living thing is going to Uganda, being there in Masindi for 2 years, and really getting to know people on a day-to-day basis, not just for a short period of time. That's why I think the Peace Corps is such an important experience in this country, because young people go to another country and they stay in that place and teach or do whatever they do for a two-year period of time. If they're open to things, then all kinds of things can happen. And the one most wonderful thing that happens is that thing that we never learn, and we fight wars because of it. We're fighting them regularly because we don't see the people on the other side as being, hey, just like me. So my whole experience in Africa, as in anywhere else, has been this just like me experience. And it's a heck of a thing to think that we have to go there to learn this. Maybe other people don't have to, I did. And that made it possible for me to establish relationships with people like Mazi Tatu Zainani.
Yes.
That was just wonderful. I mean, in the end, we spoke the same language. My Xhosa was halting at first, but after a while, we were able. We both have sort of ironic senses of humor and sometimes rather off-the-wall humor and so forth. And we were able to communicate that with each other. And to really, I think of all the people I have met in my life. She's the closest I have ever met, I've ever met. So it's a simple lesson, but it's a lesson human beings don't learn. And we fight each other and destroy each other right up until the 21st century because of that. So that was really very, very important to me. Yeah, so, you know, when summer comes, I have to confess, I no longer have the airports no longer entice me. If all I'm going to do is just go to a place and wander around, I like to wander around, but not to know people. You know, not really to get to know people. So tourism became something that was impossible for me after my experiences in Africa. These were lessons taught to me not by professors, you know, but by everyday human beings. Hmm. Human beings who had nothing at all. So that was very important to me, I think.
Okay. Project of the University of Wisconsin. This is August 17th, 2005. This is the second day of interviews with Professor Harold Shoaib of African Languages and Literature. We're going to begin today's interview with Professor Shoaib commenting on the department here, the growth and development of SAME. Harold?
We just celebrated our 40th anniversary last year of the department, so it's a relatively new department. And as I said earlier, it's the only degree-granting department of African Languages and Literature in this country, and one of the few outside Africa. My friends in Africa are always express amazement that a landlocked university like the University of Wisconsin could have such wide international reach. And of course it always has. It always has been an international institution. And so it made complete sense that Africa would become a part of that international reach. The department was established, I mentioned this earlier too, was established mainly by two faculty members who were actually not, who were in other departments, who were in history department, that's Jan van Sina and Philip Curtin. And they were, there's a lot of interest in a department which would provide scholarly study of African languages. And one reason being to prepare students to deal with history and anthropology in the actual languages. But their interests went beyond that. They were also interested in the oral traditions, in linguistics, in literature of Africa as well. So in the 60s, then those two began to put it together. I think that Curtin was the first chair of the department, and then Van Sina was, and then they gave it over to the actual members of the department. So there was a very close relationship between the African Languages and Literature Department and the African Studies program for a while, and then we sort of were weaned away from that to become an independent department. The initial faculty are interesting. It was really an international faculty. My major professor, A.C. Jordan, from South Africa, a political exile from apartheid South Africa, was on the an initial faculty member. So was Lyndon Harries, who is from England, and he was a Swahili expert. Neil Skinner, who is from New Zealand, was the Hausa expert, as time went on, then we had a couple of people who were specifically interested in literature, and so very slowly the department began to grow. We brought Idris Mockward into the department, and he had a special interest in Francophone African literature, and also taught Wolof. He's from Senegal. When I came to the university to study for my PhD, it was everything was brand new. The courses were very new, and I was there were very few. I was one of the few graduate students in the department at that time. So we were very small, and at that early time, it took a decade before the department began to look beyond graduate work and develop courses for undergraduates as well. But initially, it was mainly a graduate student department, not by design necessarily, but that's what happened. And as I said earlier, I was the second graduate. Phil Noss was the first PhD graduate of this department, and in fact, Phil was on the faculty here for a while, and then because of his interest in Bible translation. He left the department and developed a career. He just retired last year, doing Bible translation. He was in Cameroon, in Kenya, in England, in various places. One of the interesting things about speaking of Phil about the graduate students in the department is, if you can imagine, if there's only one degree granting Department of African Languages and Literature in your country, one of the problems that we have had is what about our graduate students? What happens to them? What kind of careers do they develop? And we have had, I think a sizable, a reasonable number of graduate students over these 40 years. And it's interesting to see the kinds of careers that they have developed. One of the early students, Deirdre LePin, she was here this summer. Went into international, all kinds of international. She worked for the United Nations. She worked for the State Department in Africa, and then later on in the Middle East as well. We've had students who have gone into the Voice of America, a number of students who went into the UN. So there have been all kinds of interesting and imaginative careers that have evolved out of this degree. Typically, students would come, and that's still pretty much the case. Students would not necessarily get their bachelor's degree in the department. They would come from elsewhere. We've had English majors, history majors, anthro majors, and so forth, who would come into the department and then get their advanced degrees here. So it's only been recently that we're beginning to see undergrads who get their degrees and then go on to graduate work in the department. What happened early on then was there was a great emphasis on language training and a great emphasis on literature. Oral tradition was there, the thing that particularly interests me, but it was, Lyndon Harries taught the Swahili oral tradition. A.C. Jordan very definitely taught Xhosa and Zulu oral traditions. So the oral traditions were there. But not major aspects of the department. This would come later. Linguistics was there, but it would also evolve more fully later on. Initially, it was mainly language and literature, as the title of the department suggests. And it was a very exciting time because it was a new fledgling department. When Vansina and Curtin sort of moved away from the department, the department was on its own, it was a challenging kind of a time for everybody. But I remember the early courses that I took, they were extraordinary. They were very exciting. I really fell early under the influence of Jordan in the classroom, and he began to move me in the direction of South Africa as far as my research interests were concerned. There was an informal kind of a facet to the department. Aside from the formal classroom work, there were a lot of extracurricular meetings in this very small department between faculty and students. So it was a very integrated, very interesting department. I really enjoyed it in this huge university and these very, very small classes and a small department. In the 70s, Professor Jordan died in 68. And then it wasn't. Professor Harry's retired, and so a new faculty was coming into being. I came on the faculty in 1970. I got my PhD in 69. I had a postdoc for a year, and then I went on the faculty. And then, as I said earlier, I had this pulse in the, through the 70s and into the 80s of teaching for a couple of years and then going to Africa for a year.
Yes.
So there was this great emphasis in the department on doing original research in Africa. And in fact, there's an interesting thing that happened in the history of this department. And it's maybe it's in the nature of things, but in the early years, in the 70s and into the 80s, there was a lot of interest in our graduate students in oral traditions. And we had a number of graduate students who went to Africa and did original work collecting oral traditions, the same kind of thing that I had done in Southern Africa. There were students who were interested in literature and written materials, and they got they were getting doing PhD work as well. But in the 80s, and then very definitely up until the present time, there was a shift, and a very dynamic shift into the literatures, and something that I have really struggled against in the department, greater and greater interest in the literature as anthropology and in the literature as history, and not in the literature as literature, which is my special interest. And in fact, in the journals of the in the field, articles and so forth that are written by scholars have, there's no question, right from the very beginning of African studies in this country, African literature, the idea has been to see African literature as a historical or anthropological kind of a thing. And that's not the way I see it. And So there's been that interesting and you know, scholarly kind of debate that has gone on. I've kind of enjoyed that, but at the moment I've lost that debate in this department, because the development of the department has very definitely been in the direction of a cultural view of these works rather than an aesthetic view of these works. So that's been an interesting kind of an internal. A very civilized debate, but very definitely a debate. And in the 70s, my view was in the ascendancy, but as I said, in the late 80s and until now, there's been a very definite shift. And you know, most students, for example, my seminars in oral tradition are not as well attended now as they used to be. The students will take them, but there was a much greater interest, I think, in the oral traditions of Africa earlier than there is right now. It'll come back. These are sort of waves or phases that I think departments go through.
So there are trends. There are in a sense, fashionable, that's
sure.
Perhaps unfair, trends in scholarly work?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, the debates get fierce at times, as academic debates are wont to do. I've long since understood that that's the nature of academics, and so that I think that kind of debate also strengthens the department. That there is this kind of internal sort of debate that's going on. It's not always fun to lose the debates, but
yes.
Again, that's in the nature of things. There is an interest in the oral tradition. Now, but certainly not as intense as it once was, I think. And we certainly, one of my big things in the last decade has been, look, we're losing African languages every year, in a natural kind of a way, with major languages like Swahili or languages from outside like English and French. There are a lot of languages that are dying, and they've never been codified, they've never been written down, their oral traditions have not been collected. And my argument has been to an imaginative graduate student, what a wonderful challenge this would be. Yes, you cannot learn the language here because the languages are not taught, they're not written down yet. And to go there and to do language training and oral traditions training, it seems to me that would be a very exciting kind of a thing to do for the PhD and beyond. But I haven't been able to interest not even the faculty much in that sort of thing. We do have an interest in language, but not to the extent that we're urging and training our graduate students, you know, to go to Africa and to do that training. So from a broad historical point of view, it's very tragic that we're losing the languages. I mean, I understand that languages live and die. I'm not arguing for this a museum kind of a language in Africa, but I am lamenting the fact that we're losing this whole heritage of a people. There are languages in the ethnologue on the internet. You can see. You can go through the languages of Africa, 2,000 languages, and here's a language that 400 people speak today. Well, is that a language anymore? I mean, it's rapidly disappearing. A language that maybe 10,000 people speak. And so these languages are, without any question, as Africa becomes more and more sort of monolithic, I think we're going to lose more and more of those languages. And that's a tragedy in the sense that they're just an echo. We'll never have any description of the language or any of the traditions of the language. So, and it seems to me that probably is a far greater, should be a far greater interest of this department than going to the library and do library dissertations on Chinua Achebe, for example, or something. I don't deny that those dissertations are not important, but the excitement of and the importance of going to Africa, going into areas where research has never been done before, wow, I think that would be very exciting. But it's been difficult to get students excited about that, difficult of getting the faculty excited about it. Uh-huh. From time to time, I get sort of revved up and try, but it hasn't had much of an impact. So, I think that here, this department could make an incredible contribution to world, to cultures within the world. I just think that we could do wonderful things, and maybe that will come. But a lot of it's going to come too late, because the languages will be gone, and we see this in South Africa, the Khoi language, the so-called Hottentot language, it's gone. We have echoes of it in other languages in South Africa where it had influences, but the Khoi language itself is gone. And by and large, there may be pockets of some residual elements of it. But a linguist from the University of the Witwatersrand in South Africa a couple of years ago talked about going out into the desert and seeing this woman who was probably the last speaker of one of the San languages, the so-called Bushman languages of South Africa. And even she was very old then when he met her, and she was not speaking that language anymore either. But he had one of these old recordings, wire recording, those old,
yes,
from the 30s, I think. And he played it for her. And it was about a girl's puberty rite of passage. And suddenly, the language started to come back to her. And it's just a beautiful little excerpt of a girl growing into womanhood, and how everybody is admiring her beauty as she is preparing on the cusp of adulthood. And the woman remembered that, this old woman, and we have this young woman, and the generations sort of came together for just a moment. But when she died, the language died with her. And that's a dramatic story of what's happening to a lot of languages. A lot of them we just don't have any, there's just been very, very little work done. So anyway, and I just think that this is something that we should be enormously interested in and concerned about. Because some African universities, in fact, one of the good, really good things that we have done is that some of our earlier, we had a lot more Africans as graduate students than we do now. Part of the reason is economics. A lot of the African countries simply cannot afford fellowships to send students abroad. But a lot of our graduate students went back and established departments themselves, and in Zambia, in Nigeria, in various places, and I would have hoped that in those cases too, there would have been efforts made to collect these materials. But establishing a department, as I know from our department, takes some time to do, and so maybe there hasn't been enough time for that yet. But that's, I think that's the part of the international aspects of this department, and I think these are things that we should revisit regularly, and we do. So in the 70s, then we began to grow, and then we began. There was a lot of pressure from South Hall on departments like ours that had very, very low enrollments.
South Hall being the Center for the College of Letters
and Science. The dean, a lot of pressure was brought on us in the 70s. In fact, I thought we were going to just be allowed to die.
Really?
Department, it was a very rough time because our enrollments were not, we had graduate students in our program, in our courses, and the courses just were not from the point of view at that time. They were looking at things pretty much from an economic point of view, and we were worried whether we would survive. It was a very tough time, late 70s.
And who was Dean then?
I'm trying to remember. He was I forgot his name. He's a mathematician.
Epstein?
No. And he really did bring pressure on us. I was chair for a while during that period, and remember very well the difficulties that we were having. We had from the very beginning known that we were going to develop an undergraduate program, and this sort of hastened that. In order to attract more students, then we began developing an undergraduate program. And this helped the department. The department's also, from the university's point of view, the department widened itself, broadened itself, touching the undergraduate population. And I think that was a useful kind of a thing for us to do. I know it was. During part of this time, I was chair, and we were really making an effort using whatever. Whatever research interests or teaching interests the faculty had to develop courses, undergraduate courses within these areas. And this was when Lyndon Harries was still around. He had developed a very good undergraduate course. And then others did as well. And Idris Makwar developed a course in African autobiography, which was quite a good course, I think. And then in the early 80s, I developed a course. I developed a number of courses in both literature and oral traditions. And I developed a course for undergraduates called the African Storyteller. And I had no idea what was going to happen to this course. It was a combination. First part of the course dealt with oral traditions, second part with literature. And it was for students who had no background in African literature at all. So initially, it gave literature credit and humanities credit to students. Oh. And it was just really an interesting thing. I think 82 is when it started, or maybe a little earlier. And I went over to the SOAR. I was involved in SOAR from a very early period. I don't think it was called SOAR yet at that early period.
This is the
student orientation and advising and registration. But I went there and talked to the advisors and talked to students, freshmen, about what the course was like. And so it was one of these courses that grew like Topsy. It started off with maybe 40, and then as time, I taught it every semester, and it moved very rapidly, and I kept moving from one classroom to another, larger and larger and larger classrooms. I remember I was in the agricultural building at one point. I was over in the Rennebaum room of the pharmacy building at one point. And it went, to 200, then 300, And then the largest room that I was able to get then, and the room that I really love, was 272 Bascom, which seats 487 students. So the enrollments went up to a 500 then. And, wow. And that's every semester. And they remained at 500 throughout the 80s, into the 90s, and right up into the present moment. Then this year, there was a committee that decided that somewhere along the way, they also allowed my course to provide ethnic studies, provide credit for the ethnic studies requirement. And so I had students from every college on this campus, and it was just a nice mix of students. I really enjoyed it. I loved the big class. And I remember the Daily Cardinal a year ago, when this committee came into being, forecast that they would take away the ethnic studies requirement because what they wanted to do was to focus this on only African American or Hispanic American or Asian American and not this broader international kind of view. And they forecast that it would kill my course. So we really had, it was a real in-your-face kind of a set of discussions with this organization. I very carefully outlined what I did in my course and made the case for it being an ethnic studies course. But they wouldn't hear it. If I wasn't going to transform it into an African-American course, then they would remove the ethnic studies. So this semester they had removed it. And so I wasn't quite sure, still not quite sure how it's going to eventuate. But today, this morning, it's at 400. So you know, the reports of its death were premature. What angered me about the thing, I think angry was the word, was the way it was done. I mean, my argument is, one of the strengths of this university is its international aspects. And what an opportunity for students who are engineers or who or will never, you know, take courses like this, to have an opportunity to take a course that is far outside their majors, that satisfies this ethnic studies requirement. Because for my money, and I'm not the only one who feels like this, and I'm not the only one who lost the ethnic studies requirement, that you know, there's an argument to be made, which this committee was not hearing at all, for there to be, Hebrew studies, Asian studies, Slavic studies, African studies. But anyway, so as of the moment, that's gone. And I'm not bitter, but I just don't like the way it was done. Uh-huh. And I also think that it goes against what this university stands for, and that troubles me. So, but anyway, it hasn't killed the course. That was important to me simply because it was the way the struggle took place during this past year. Whatever happens to it, you know, I got plenty of courses that I can teach and so forth. My graduate seminars, because I'm teaching a graduate seminar this semester in oral traditions, and they languish a bit. I've got 6 people so far in the graduate seminar. This may grow a bit, but the seminars are generally relatively small. That's not the way they always were, but given these interests and maybe all kinds of other aspects as well, maybe. But I think that oral traditions and literature are holding their own.
Harold, I have to go back to your course in storytelling. Mm-hmm. Your colleague Magdalena Hauner said that you grade all of the essays and that you don't use TAs.
Right.
That you teach it. And she said it's quite extraordinary that your comments, not only do you grade the essays and the exam, but that you actually write significant comments.
That's right.
And she encouraged me to have you talk about the kinds of things you say, why you do that, because there are so few, if any, professors who take that approach. And to such a huge course as well.
Yeah, this is my philosophy of teaching. I mean, it would be easy for me to go into the classroom 3 days a week, lecture, and then just leave. if I had TAs, they could take, you know, they could take over the breaking it down into sections, and marking exams and so forth. But you know, I really feel a real obligation to my students, and therefore, you know, for example, I tell the students in my course outline and also at the beginning of the year that I'm not really much interested in email, that I really want face-to-face discussions with them. That, you know, you can send me email if it's a quick kind of a thing, but if we're going to discuss something, we're going to discuss it in my office. So I have really lots of office hours, and as we get closer to exams, you know, wall-to-wall office hours. And so I see a great number of my students on an individual basis.
Really?
Some students don't like that. They would prefer to avoid, especially, you know, one of the things that happens, of course, this must have been the case since teachers like Plato, is the age difference between faculty and students. And I talked very frankly about that to my students, you know, that it would appear that, you know, that, and at SOAR, I heard some SOAR guides talking to students this summer saying that they prefer TAs because they're of their same age, you know. And so here's this ancient, and I refuse to do that. Students have to deal with this old man, and some of them, you know, some of them have. I don't think they ever really come to terms with that. And some of them, I think, some students, maybe out of their own philosophies, never really come in to see me at all, see professors at all. But by and large, they do, and they find out that we talk the same language, and that is, you know, that the age difference may not be as monumental as they might think it is. But the main thing is, from my philosophy of teaching, you know, I have a real obligation to my students, and that obligation doesn't end after I give a lecture, you know, that it goes on. And so it goes on in my discussions here, and then I give three exams during the semester, and the first two exams are the ones that are, I don't comment on the final exams because they don't get those back. But the first two, especially the first one, I work very hard on that. What happens every semester is for 2 weeks, two-week periods, I'm persona non grata. All I do is mark exams. I meet my classes and so forth, have my office hours, but only my regular office hours. The rest of the time, I'm